Hey, Dr. B.
Hey, Luke. How are things going?
You know, it's interesting. Things are technically fine, I guess, but I just don't feel satisfied. I feel like there's got to be more to it.
Ooh, yeah. I know the feeling that you're talking about. Have you heard of coaching before? Because I feel like you might be a really great candidate for that. It's perfect for people who, you know, feel like there's more to give but don't exactly know how to get into it. And so whether that's like really savoring the life that you do have or really bringing in more meaningful things into your life, that could be a really, really great help.
Sometimes we just feel stuck, even when everything seems like it's going fine. If you can relate, maybe you just need to hear another perspective. Check out mymoderntherapy.com to make an appointment with Dr. Beatrice Craven or one of her associates. Or give them a call at 281-783-9297 and tell them Luke sent you. Again, that's mymoderntherapy.com. From Milieu Media Group, this is The H, a podcast about the people and places that make Houston, Houston. I'm your host, Luke Brauner, and this is Season 3, Episode 2, Beyond Cool with Cam Franklin. This is a little embarrassing to admit, but because I believe art is at its best when it's created from a place of vulnerability and in pursuit of truth, I'll confess. I spent a significant amount of my childhood, adolescence, and young adulthood wrestling with the following question. What is cool? Like, what does it mean, or maybe what does it take to be cool? As a kid, with all my youthful insecurity and self-absorption, believing everyone around me was constantly observing and weighing my every move, cool seemed like a mystery worth solving and a status worth pursuing. At times, I believed it had to do with the clothes people wore. Jabot jeans or Guess overalls with only one strap buckled and a hypercolor t-shirt felt like a surefire answer to the question. But eventually, it became less about clothes and more about personality. How funny was a person? How willing were they to get in trouble? How nice were they to other people? Today, though, I'd have to say none of those things are the common thread among the folks who strike me as particularly cool. Being cool has significantly more to do with the lack of self-absorption. People who just don't base their every move on what others tell them they should or shouldn't do or think or say or believe. I didn't learn that lesson early enough, but one person who did was Houston native Cam Franklin.
My name is Cam Franklin, and I am the lead singer for The Suffers, a Gulf Coast soul band based in Houston, Texas.
Prior to this interview, I'd never heard anything described as Gulf Coast soul, but The Suffers aren't the first to describe themselves that way. According to Cam, the genre originated with 1960s Beaumont-based singer and guitarist Barbara Lynn, whose music, consequently, I've been obsessing over since my conversation with Cam in early September of 2018.
I've heard a few different people use the term previously, but when we first got started, people were trying to slap that whole vintage soul label on us, and it was like, why? You know, I don't, a lot of the bands that we were being compared to were doing kind of, you know, the traditionalist 50s, 60s soul, but we weren't going that route at all. And I think the only thing that might have been in that same vein was probably the way we were dressing at the time. But now, you know, that we've found ourselves, I guess, fashionably, the music's also evolved into this whole new place. I think the whole point of us claiming Gulf Coast soul was to say, look, we're from Houston, we're from the Gulf Coast, you know, we're going to have all of these different influences in our music that maybe you aren't familiar with. And before you slap the label on just because you've seen a press photo, you might actually want to listen to the music so you don't sound crazy or lazy later on.
Cam and her younger brother Langston spent their earliest years living with their mom in a predominantly Mexican neighborhood off Telephone and Belfort near South Park in southeast Houston. Although their parents weren't together, they were both still very involved in the kids' lives.
Even though her and my dad weren't getting along at that time, she was always really good about making sure that he got his time with us. And so weekends, summers, they were his, and most holidays we spent with him. But, you know, it was definitely a co-parenting relationship, so definitely both of them.
When she was 11 years old, she got two new siblings, her stepbrother James and her stepsister Ashley.
I grew up with them twice. Our parents got married the first time when I was 11. They divorced when I was 14, and then they remarried when I was 18. And they've been together ever since.
Cam attributes much of who she is today, including her diverse musical taste, to the neighborhood in which she spent those early years.
The neighborhood I grew up in was all Mexican, and so Mexican culture was a very, very large part of my life growing up. So even though, you know, I loved what we were listening to in my house, you know, Luther Vandross and Stevie Wonder and all this, these amazing gospel artists, I still also had influences from Selena and Celia Cruz and La India and Juan Gabriel. And so I had almost like two cultures growing up.
Eventually, though, everything changed. Cam and her family ended up moving to North Houston to live in Acres Homes.
When my parents moved away, I feel like I lost a lot of what I had learned. Like, I was learning Spanish through my friends growing up. And then when we moved to Acres Homes, I had nobody to speak Spanish with. And it created this kind of like weird identity crisis for me, because, you know, not growing up around Black people that weren't related to me, it was my first time really being in a social situation as, I guess, like a preteen or whatever with other Black people. And so it was almost like a race to prove how Black I was with people that just weren't used to seeing Blackness in a different way at that time. It was a sad time, but it allowed me to just kind of discover who I was, because I was like, I'm not going to change who I am to kind of cater to y'all. So, you know, if you want to be my friend, cool. If you don't want to be my friend, cool. But what ended up happening is that I eventually found other Black people that were in kind of a similar situation as me, where we grew up in just a different way. And so we didn't sound like what everybody thought, you know, a Houston Black person was supposed to sound like. And we listened to other stuff beyond, you know, just hip hop and R&B, even though those were great loves. And it just kind of laid a foundation for a completely different kind of person.
Okay, so you mentioned it was sort of a race to prove your Blackness, mm-hmm. the Black part of your identity. What did that actually look like?
The first introduction to it for me was, you know, meeting other, you know, young Black kids that were like, you sound white. You talk white. You don't talk like a Black person. And me just kind of questioning, what the hell does Black sound like? I'm looking in the mirror like, this isn't makeup. So either you're confused or I'm confused. But, you know, when you bring those conversations back home to your parents that have never really acknowledged that side of the issue that lies within our culture, it's confusing, and they just kind of like chalk it up to bullying, but not really acknowledging the fact that it's a much bigger issue that deals with not only the lack of education, but also the lack of exposure to other forms of Blackness. The acknowledgement that we too are complex human beings with different forms and thoughts and ideas, but, you know, when you're used to only seeing yourself one way, especially in media, it kind of goes back to that whole ideology of representation mattering and why the need for all forms of Blackness, all forms of all shades of people to be represented in popular culture. And for me, like, I didn't have any of that, and neither did these kids. So it was just like this mass confusion of, well, you know, are they wrong or am I wrong? My parents, they were from San Antonio, and they too hadn't grown up around very many Black people that weren't Black people they went to church with or their family. Like, they lived in all Mexican neighborhoods as well. And so they talked differently. And it was something that, you know, they dealt with in their own way. And I think that's probably why they weren't so vocal on guiding me as to what to do. But now I'm kind of like equal parts resentful, but also grateful that they did it, so that I was able to kind of like fend for myself and figure it out and how to defend myself when it came to those social situations. Now, when it happens, like, it becomes more so a, okay, if someone tells me I talk white, I'm like, I think you need to read some more books. You know, it wasn't until, honestly, I read more books by Black authors where I was like, wow, I'm missing out on so much. Like, I thought they were missing out. I'm missing out on so much. And was, you know, through James Baldwin and Zora Neale Hurston and Toni Morrison, was able to really see how complex we are and how complex we've always been without, like, needing to really see anything.
Even as a kid, Cam was always musically inclined. Her dad sang, her grandmother sang, her cousin sang, everyone sang.
I've been singing since I was 5, and I really have never imagined myself not being a musician, even in the years where I had, you know, a more regular job and a more normal lifestyle. I was always an artist in some kind of way. And even when I would try to suppress it, it would still crawl back out. And your life just easier when you embrace it.
So she did, spending much of her time in both school choir and church choir.
When it comes to Black Baptist churches, especially in the South, music is a huge part of that culture. And it's something that I never really acknowledged as a true foundation for my musical career until I got much older and realized that a lot of the stuff that I see as not complex is very hard for a lot of people that didn't grow up doing that music.
That realization really began when she transferred from Carver High School, a magnet school in Aldean ISD with a curricular emphasis on performing arts, visual arts, and engineering, to Clear Creek, a public high school in League City.
I would say in high school, I realized that I could do a little bit more than my peers could when literally every other week I was being accused of doing too much, because I was, you know, in a choir that was all about choral music. And so when I would blend, I guess I was blending so well that they would accuse me of not singing. And so I'm like, which one do you want? Do you want me to sing because I'm singing? Or do you want me to be me? Because when I'm me, I get in trouble. So I'm not sure what version of myself I'm supposed to be giving here.
Unfortunately, no matter how much she worked to satisfy her choir directors, Cam's choral problems followed her even beyond the classroom.
So TMEA, Texas Music Educators Association, has the statewide competition every year where you audition in your district, and then it goes from district to region to state auditions. And to make all state, you have to be the top 8 singers in this group of 25. And to make it to regionals, I believe it's the top 50 from the districts, and you basically have your own auditions at your school. Those people go to the district auditions, and then you go to region and then state. And if you make it to all state, you then are part of the Texas State Choir. And to be at the top, you have to be the top 4. The top 4 from each of the state winners becomes part of the Texas Mixed Choir. And then number 5 through number 8, you become part of the Texas Men's Choir or the Texas Women's Choir. And all of you perform with the people that are from band and orchestra that won all state for their respective things. And as far as like music nerd Texas accolades are concerned, you make all state like you are the singer, you are whatever. And so I would always do well at districts and go to regional, and regional is always where I would get the cut. I'd always be like that one right before the people that were allowed to move on. You know, if this were the Olympics, I would be 4th place every freaking time. And it would be painful and embarrassing. And, you know, if you weren't part of that group that went, you come back home and everyone in choir just looks at you like, but you're so good. Did you mess up on your sight reading? Did you mess up on this? And sometimes there would be no mistakes and you'd never know why, because they wouldn't give you notes. They wouldn't tell you where you went wrong. And so it would just create this whole, like, I'm not good enough mindset.
While her choir directors didn't fully appreciate what she could do vocally, even going so far as to ask her to leave the choir during her senior year, fortunately, there were others around who did appreciate her talent.
Thankfully, I had some theater teachers of mine that were like my saving grace, because the school had started a musical theater program and they were like, actually, you're eligible for this if you want to be a part of this with us. And so that ended up being the connection that I needed and kind of like the reminder that there isn't only one way to be an artist, because I had never really been exposed to musical theater before that and didn't realize that it was a thing. I was like, oh, this is how you get to Broadway. The guys in choir were convincing me that I had to do it their way. And they were the first ones to tell me, choir doesn't teach you how to entertain.
The other thing that happened during her senior year is that Cam joined her first band, a punk/ska group called the Blue Lights, and got to experience how it felt when people looked at her as an entertainer rather than just some underachieving singer.
So when I started singing in clubs and doing more open mics and working with professional musicians that, you know, did it all the time, that was when I realized I could keep up, because all that theory, all that, you know, stuff that they told me I would have to learn if I wanted to do vocal performance professionally, none of it mattered. All that mattered was, could I sing? Could I be consistent? Could I stay in tune? Could I entertain? And I realized, I was like, I can entertain for sure. And that's what set me apart, was that I wasn't here to be the best singer. I was here to be the best everything that I could personally be. And nobody freaking told me that that's the difference. You can go to school for vocal performance, spend all that money, learn as much about music theory and music history as possible, and never be able to find a job. Unless you want to teach it, which is fine and great if that's what you want to do. But a lot of times that's not what those people want to do. They go, they get those degrees, and then they're like, why can't I find a job? Why is Cam all of a sudden doing so much better than me? You know, she didn't go to Allstate with me. She didn't go and have all of these musical accolades that I had all through high school. Sometimes because I wasn't given the opportunity, sometimes because my tone wasn't considered classic enough for what they wanted it to be. So it's like, I might not have been good enough for opera or for choral music, but I'm good enough for soul music and punk music and country music and folk music and literally everything else.
She continued playing with the Blue Lights for a couple years after graduating high school. And although the band never made a huge name for itself, it did help establish Cam as a presence in the Houston music scene. When the Blue Lights ended, she found herself as part of a sort of Houston music collective made up of staple players from the local punk, reggae, and ska scenes that called themselves The Pocket. They'd get together to play a big sold-out show twice a year as they all worked on their individual music projects, several of which have seen a fair amount of regional and national success.
It's just interesting to see how this is all so connected, because all of us have known each other for a better part of, you know, 15, 20 years now, and none of us ever saw it going this way. We just all knew this is what we were supposed to be doing. And I would always talk about how there was a collective, even though we weren't really acknowledging it, we're all still so connected to where it's like the collective exists. We're all still bumping each other up and we have the opportunity to do so. But it's more so about taking the time to not only kind of represent Houston, but to acknowledge that what we're doing is contributing to that next generation of Houston musician culture, Houston and beyond culture. Like, because so many people move, they're from here and they move away, and people don't realize how much Houston has contributed to modern music.
Throughout those years, Cam was also attending college at Texas Southern University and having a cultural experience she long felt she'd missed out on as a kid.
Like, I thought I was only by myself and the only person like this, honestly, until I got to college. And I went to Texas Southern, honestly, to get that Black experience that I really hadn't gotten as a kid, that I wasn't really, like, welcomed into when I was in middle school and in high school. And so going to Texas Southern, it was the first time I found other black people that were like me, that weren't always welcome in the hood because maybe we were too, you know, nerdy or weird or whatever. And it kind of became like my true introduction to just discovery of who I am now. And honestly, it wasn't until I got to Texas Southern and really started learning more and seeing more like-minded individuals and seeing all of the different forms of blackness coming from all over the world to that school where I really got to see like, oh, wait, I'm normal.
After a few years, the Pocket stopped playing their annual shows. Everyone went their separate ways and the thought of being a career musician sort of fell off Cam's radar. But as it turned out, although she believed she was done with music, music wasn't quite done with her.
So when we stopped doing our annual shows, the bass player, Adam Castaneda, and the keys player, Patrick Kelly, decided to start a super group, basically, of artists that they really liked playing with or had always wanted to play with. And so I got the call. This was 2011, and I wasn't doing anything. I was working a regular job at an investment bank, and I just accepted that that was going to be my life, and I could still do karaoke or something, but it probably was going to be me at this bank. And I was fine with it. That was until I went to the first rehearsal for The Suffers, and it was all these people that I'd always respected and always wanted to work with, and it was just something I never really saw happening, because I would always talk to my old bands about how I wanted to be in a band with Adam so badly, and I wanted to be in a band with Pat. Like, I was like, man, if I could be with them, I would, you know, learn so much. And but no, I showed up, and at the time, it was 9 guys, and all I could think was, whew, this is going to be a lot. But I was like, if I can figure out a way to make this work, it'll be real cool. And so we did.
But you knew in that first rehearsal?
I knew. I knew in the way that people talk about meeting their spouses that, you know, this is the love of my life. They are definitely the loves of my life. They drive me insane, and I want to kill them sometimes. I tell them, I'm like, I'll kill all of you tomorrow. But, I mean, at the same time, they're my family, and I love them, and I couldn't have seen myself doing this with anybody else. But yeah, we initially had the goal of just being a cover band. Like, we would do rock and soul, rocksteady covers of popular music, and it evolved into what it is now when we started bringing in originals and embracing the fact that maybe we are a soul band. And now it's funny and fun.
This place feels like home, but I ain't got no keys. I just need some floor space to rest these tired feet. Just show me what I need to do, then tell me. All these dreams I have, but no to see.
The Suffers' first big break came about a year later, in 2012, when they received an invitation to play at the renowned Austin Reggae Fest.
That was our first, like, big festival. They had reached out to us and gave us the 420 slot, which was hilarious. But there were so many people that had never seen us before that got introduced to us that day because of that festival. And for us, like, we had always wanted to play it. And some of the guys in Scarnolas had played it before. But for me, like, I'd never played it before. And it showed me, like, okay, I'm meant to be on stages this big. I can hold my own. I can do what I need to do. All these festivals that used to seem so unattainable, as soon as I had the product that was right, all of a sudden the opportunity started just flowing in.
They spent the next couple years really hustling, writing songs, playing shows, and building a following, until eventually, in early 2015, they had no choice but to quit their day jobs and focus all their efforts on the band.
We quit our job January 30th of 2015, and I mean, we all still kind of gig on the side. Like, I do a lot of studio work, you know, and some of the guys will take, like, odd jobs, side jobs, because, you know, you got to pay the bills, and the money is not always where it needs to be. Like, we are not in a place yet where, you know, we're balling out of control or anything like that, so you got to hustle. But at the same time, it's like, when the job is so good, you'll take less money to make it work. You'll figure it out to make it work. And so the universe keeps making it work for us. Every time I think the ball's about to drop or whatever, I'm just like, oh, wait, oh, well, there's this check I forgot about. You know, like, it just works out.
A few months after the transition to being full-time, they received another huge opportunity to bring their Gulf Coast soul to a major stage. This time, on the David Letterman Show.
It was surreal. He was really nice. Everybody there was really kind and honestly exactly like what you would see on TV. But it was intimidating and very cold. The theater was like 40 degrees. It was life-changing in a way that it kind of just solidified that we were supposed to be here, not so much in a like a fame kind of way. A lot of people think you play something like that and you're famous, so you're going to make all this money, and it's like, you don't get paid to do that. You don't get, you know, a certain amount of fame from that, but what you do get is a little boost of exposure, and people start taking you a lot more seriously when you say you've played Letterman than they probably would have before. But it is something that if I am feeling discouraged, I will go back and I'll watch the video. And it's kind of like, well, if Letterman says that I'm supposed to be here, then it doesn't really matter what anybody else thinks. Ooh, let me fit you.
Since that Letterman performance, the Suffers have released two full-length albums and toured relentlessly throughout the U.S. and beyond. They're easily one of the hardest-working acts in Texas, and it's paying off in the form of an ever-growing national following. But no matter how far they travel or how large their audience grows, they never stop representing the city that first embraced them. And it's embraced them well. In fact, Mayor Sylvester Turner even declared July 13, 2018, the release day for their sophomore album, Everything Here, the Suffers Day in Houston.
The city has done more for us than, I mean, I could probably ever imagine. They've embraced us as their own. I feel like because we've been so rowdy about representing Houston, it's been even more of a enthusiasm to kind of like latch on to what it is we're doing. We're very loved here. We're very respected here. And we're very grateful for that. For us, it's more so just about making sure that we're not stalling out just because we're being loved, because that's how laziness occurs. You know, you think everything's good. You think, oh, you know, life's cush. Like, let's just chill. Let's stop working so hard. But it's like, working hard is what got you there. Working hard is what's going to keep us here. And, you know, making sure that we are not forgetting where we come from, but at the same time, not being afraid to push through and keep moving and trying to figure out like how to write music the way we want to write it, trying to figure out how to maintain that work-life balance, how to, you know, make more money without, you know, killing ourselves on the road. And so it's a lot of just learning and the willingness to learn. You know, it's really hard to be an artist and to admit that you don't know everything. And, you know, people would be like, oh, no, that should be normal. It's like, it's not. So many artists think they know everything, unless someone that they admire tells them otherwise. And it's hard to admit that you don't know everything and that you need help and that sometimes the help you're getting isn't the help that you need. And I'm excited to see where we go next. I'm excited to, you know, keep continuing to push forward and continuing my education as far as not only the business side of what we do, but also as a creative and just working to get better and better and better and better. One thing that we've been pretty steadfast on is using Houston videographers and photographers and artists for a lot of our stuff, because we understand that because we do so well now, it means so much more as a brand to have those local artists involved in what we do. And when we do have the opportunity to use them and to give them a platform, we try to do that. But it's it's hard. It's hard. You want to help everybody. You want to do everything, even though you know you can't do everything. And I don't know. We're kind of just in a... and the next phase of our life as a band. And it's exciting and scary, but I am so looking forward to it.
In my childhood quest to understand what it means to be cool, what I eventually learned, as I mentioned, is that it's somehow related to being authentic, to being real. It was about being secure in who you are, even if, or perhaps especially if, you're the only one like you. But what I've discovered as an adult is that those characteristics make a person far more than cool. What I see in Cam Franklin is a person who knows who she is and where she comes from. A person who's strong. Who holds confidence and humility in perfect balance. A person who finds her self-worth not in her accomplishments or in her abilities or in the opinions of those around her, whether they be critical choir directors or gushing late-night TV hosts, but in simply being who she was made to be. Unapologetically. I admire that. I admire her, and I'm so thankful for the gift she is to this city.
Let me light your cigarette and lay your shoes down by the door. I'll show you all the love you need. Isn't that what you came for? 'Cause I'm a giver. Hey, hey, baby, I'll be your giver.
Be sure to support The Suffers by visiting thesuffers.com and buying their music, t-shirts, stickers, etc. Huge thanks to Cam for being a part of this episode, and to Ian Sion, Alicia Harris, and the Moody Center for the Arts at Rice University for allowing us to record in their space. Thanks also, as always, to you for continuing to listen to this show. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at The H Podcast. We'll be back next week with another bonus episode, and in 2 weeks with episode 3. Thanks so much for listening. This episode was produced, edited, and mixed by me, Luke Brauner. Our artwork is by our friends at Field of Study. Visit them online at fieldofstudy.design. Our theme song is by Robbie C., and other music featured in this episode is by Cameron Passera, Scott Benton, and of course, The Suffers. This and every episode of The H is brought to you in part by Pink Cilantro, a social-first digital agency focused on marketing, branding, and just generally spreading good vibes. Check them out at pinkcilantro.com. Now here's a scene from our next episode.
I just made a bet with him right then and there, and I was like, Dad, I promise you that after I graduate high school, 2 years later, I will have my bachelor degree. And to fast forward a little bit, I ended up doing it.